a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Online yet or not. Let's call the meeting to order, and if I could get the roll. Call the roll.
Senator Bartling.
Here.
Senator Glusby. Senator Hunha.
Here.
Senator Haverly.
Here.
Senator Teason.
Here.
Representative Berg.
Here.
Representative Dennert.
Here.
Representative Junkie. Representative Peters.
Here.
Representative Turbeville.
Here.
You have a quorum.
Fantastic. And if I could get a motion for the minutes, please.
Move.
I have a motion by Representative Turbeville, a second by Senator Bartling. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none. Minutes are approved. And with that, we'll move to the first item on our agenda, the brand board. We have the executive director here to talk about the financials and to tie things out. They do an annual report, and I had a couple of emails, and I think a couple other committee members also had emails from folks that are members of the that pay dues and things into the brand board and for brand inspections, and they were trying to tie it out, and they couldn't. They had a $63,000 difference, and so we have Larry Stearns here to talk to us and kind of help us tie it out and explain why there's that variance, and hopefully we can educate the public on how this works.
Good morning. Thank you.
Is your mic on? Is the little green light on? Okay. Okay.
Nope, now it is. Okay. After our last board meeting, I gave the president of the Stock Growers a copy of our financials and also of our inspection report for the fiscal year 2009. And he did the math, and the numbers seemed to come up with a discrepancy in his mind. And the simple solution or the simple answer is that we count all of the inspections in the month in which the livestock were inspected. So if livestock was inspected in June, those are June numbers. However, our reports from our sale barns and the money that comes with them comes after the first of the following month. So even though we do have the numbers in June, the money is counted in the following month. And I did the math after I got the emails also, and it was all covered in the following month in the livestock market reports that came in. And we do this in order to be able to evaluate the amount of labor that we have to use at sale barns predominantly. The local inspections pretty much take care of themselves. We have a number of local inspectors out there who do local inspections, and if cattle need inspected, we have to have inspectors there to take care of that. They get paid by the head, so the more cattle we do, the more money comes in. On the sale barn side of it, we have 13 sale barns in South Dakota that have brand inspection, and we have 13 full-time inspectors that work at these sale barns. Several of the barns have more than one inspector, and we have 14 full-time, but some of these have more than one full-time inspector. We also have part-time people who are also local inspectors come in and help during the fall run when we have 5, 6, 7, 8, 10,000 head of cattle come into a sale barn in a 48-hour period. It takes a lot of eyes to look at that number of people. However, when the numbers are down, we encourage our full-time inspectors to limit the amount of part-time help that comes in to do this. They cost us $100 to $110 a day. If we can eliminate one part-time person in the course of a week, we can save about $1,300 in a week, which is around a little over $5,000 in a month, which is it's substantial in the brand board budget. So we do this to evaluate the amount of labor that we do that we are using, and that's pretty much the reason why the numbers don't look like they do. Now, I just dropped off a report at the LRC this morning, and that is for the calendar year 2009. So the carryover from last December into January should jive pretty close with what's carried over into January this year. So the money and the numbers should be much, much closer. They're not going to be exact. They never will be exact, but they'd be much, much closer.
Are there any questions? I do have a question. Do you ever sit down and tie it out with the month, with the 1 month lag? Do you ever sit down and truly tie it down?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Yes, I do. And it's, like I say, it isn't exact because of everything that goes on, of course. But we do come up very close every month.
Okay. Representative Dennert and then Representative Turbeville.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stearns, I just was glancing at the numbers and the number had held for inspection or proof of ownership. How long do you hold them, and do most of them get claimed or released or whatever in a satisfactory amount of time?
The vast majority of them do get claimed within the 60-day period of time that they do stay at the sale barns. However, the ones that do are a stray animal that has no owner, has no brand, nobody can claim it, or nobody does claim it, those then come into the brand board office, and then Ray Shouldis, our chief brand inspector, goes to work, and he's very good at clearing these things up, and he works his tail off, so to speak, to be able to get the money back to the rightful owners. And we do, after a fashion, probably around 6 months, if we're not able to come up with any owner on a stray animal, then that goes to a board, and the board action at that point will probably take it and refer it to the, or put it into the theft and prevention fund. If there is no owner, that's the rightful home for that funds.
Go ahead.
You mentioned right at the very start of your comments 60 days. Is the identified owner then responsible for the feed bill, I would assume?
No, the animals are sold. It's just the money that is held.
The money is held,
yes,
for that. Like, okay, thank you.
We do from time to time, of course, have some strays that are brought into a sale barn. Say it's a breeding bull or something like this. Cows aren't that big a deal as far as holding, and they'll usually sell them. Breeding bulls are something a little bit different. Somebody pays $5,000 for a bull, it strays off. Somebody picks it up, hauls it into town for a stray. They want to be able to find an owner for that, because they'll can them out for $1,000, and that's not a very good return for a 2 or 3 or 4 year old bull.
Thank you.
Representative Turbeville.
Thank you. I see you did about 382,000 in local inspections. If a rancher is looking to sell, how long in advance do they have to notify the local inspectors before they get their?
According to state law, it's 24-hour advance notice. However, many times they're called 10 minutes after they're needed, and the local inspectors try their darndest to be able to accommodate all the requests.
Okay. And you know, the situation, the brand board has been kind of up in the air the last couple of years, and I have heard or feel some complaints, especially in the northwestern part of the state, that inspectors sometimes take a lot longer than that to get there. Is this a problem, or is this just a result of the animosity with the brand board that's occurred over the last couple of years?
I'd say probably there is some credence to some of them, but quite a bit of it, I believe, is animosity. I have had I've had 3 written complaints in the last 18 months. And I have had a lot of compliments, and one of them comes from a cattle buyer out in the western area who was so happy we finally got some young inspectors up in that northwest area of the country that can get the job done. And coming from that person, it meant an awful lot to me, because I hold that person in high regard.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Senator Hunoff.
Mr. Stern, how do you tie out that actually these inspections, I mean, there's got to be a check and balance. If I don't even know what stockyards are open anymore, but if you came to, well, we don't have any West River, but let's say at Faith, if they had one, how do you tie that out, that those inspections were actually the number of head that went through there?
There are 2 different ways of looking at this. When they come through the sale barn, our inspectors fill out, they have a yard book, they write down the numbers of the livestock and the brands of the livestock and the owner. They go into their office and they tie that brand to an owner, and that goes into a tally sheet. That tally sheet then goes into the main office, and when the livestock is sold, that same number of livestock is typically paid for by the sale barn. They'll run them through and they'll match up the their receipts with the tally sheets, and then following that there is a record of sales, and then the brand or the market clearances are developed by the brand inspector to give the new owners title to their livestock. And they do jive. Once in a while, you have one or two that somebody will no-sale something, and they don't think they should have to pay brand inspection. However, if they went through the ring, they have to pay brand inspection on those.
Just another question for the chair. I'm not an accountant. Like when you're booking sales or you're booking this, why don't you do it on the month, even if the revenue's coming in? Why wouldn't you to match it out? Is that a practice? I'm just asking.
This is a different way of accounting that I'm accustomed to. So, Representative Berg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let's just say you buy cattle out in Montana or Idaho or someplace. Are they brand inspected before they get on the truck? You know, they come into the eastern South Dakota. They're not unloaded any time. Are they brand inspected then? Or
in the states that have brand inspection, the cattle are always brand inspected before they are put on the truck. The truck then can come across. If they get in Idaho, they come across Wyoming and South Dakota, going to eastern South Dakota or Minnesota. As long as they're on the truck, there's no need for any further brand inspection. The paper should come with them.
Okay, if I was going to follow up, I was just going to say, so they're, before they load those calves, because they're coming right off a ranch in most cases, they have a brand inspector there that's probably going to inspect that brand. Is that correct?
Yes, they do. They're looking for strays. They're looking for neighbor's cattle, whatever.
Because we buy thousands of head through there, and I guess I was always kind of curious at how that was worked on the other end. So, excuse me. Thank you.
Are there any further questions? I guess I do have a question. You're going to maybe have to explain to me a little bit better about the tally sheets. How do you track? I guess I'm not a rancher or a farmer, so I have no concept of how the process actually works. But if you could walk me through, someone brings in cattle, walks it through the inspection process, how you do the tally sheets and how the money's transpired, and then if you could walk me through the process, that I think that would help me a little bit understand, because I'm a little nervous about tally sheets. I'm used to having inventory counts and numbers assigned to inventory, and so tally sheets makes me a little nervous. So kind of walk me through the process a little.
Maybe it's all nomenclature. They are an inventory count. The animal comes in. They back the truck up to the I'll start right at the beginning, back up to the chute, unload the animal. The brand inspector inspects them off the chute. If they're not able to see a brand or something, they'll run them by again and again and again if they have to find a brand. They even sometimes clip the hair on the animals to be able to identify who the animal belongs to. Then, as I said before, then they develop a tally sheet. It's a sheet that they put down the number of head with each particular brand on. That tally sheet then goes in, a copy of it goes into the main office, and that becomes the office's knowledge or how they assign the money to the owner of the cattle. If John Smith and Joe Smith bring in 5 head of cattle apiece on the same load, 5 head go to John and 5 head go to Joe, and their checks are cut accordingly. The tally sheets then are compiled by the brand inspector, and once a month we get a stack of all of their tally sheets for that month, along with a kind of a compilation to how many cattle are inspected for each month at that barn. Cattle, cows, calves, heifers, steers, horses, bulls, and so forth. They break them down by species and by type. And then they send that in to us along with a check from the sale barn for 80 cents a head for all of the livestock that were sold. And then that comes into our office. The numbers then we compile as far as the numbers that were inspected, and then the money goes into the brand fund, brand inspection account of the brand fund.
And we've already kind of talked about this. So you get the tally sheets in 1 month. The next month, the money comes in. Where does the money come from?
The money comes from the sale barn. They're paying us for the 80 cents a head that the owner has paid the sale barn for the brand inspection.
Okay.
The tally sheets come in about the 5th, between the 5th and the 10th of the month. The money comes in at that same time. The money is counted as money for that month. The numbers I put back into the month in which they were inspected.
Okay. Any further questions? Representative Denner.
Well, Madam Chair, in light of it, I was going to say you count the legs and divide by four.
He'd be in trouble if he had a three-legged cow running through, though. Representative Turberville.
If I was to register a brand or buy a brand, there's a fee for that. Does your department receive all those fees?
Yes, we do. And actually, right now, we're going through the brand renewal process. We have 26,300 brands that we send out renewal notices between Christmas and about the first part of last week to the brand owners, and they have to renew their brand every 5 years for $50. It's $10 a year. When people buy a brand, say, for instance, you were to buy a brand from someone, that person receives the money that you are paying for the brand. However, we receive a $25 transfer fee for moving that from the previous owner to your name.
Okay, so your total income is generated from the renewal fees and the 80 cents inspection fees. Is there any other revenue?
That's it.
All right, thank you.
Sometimes if we do a duplicate certificate, but that's very minor.
Senator Teason.
I wasn't paying close attention. Tell me how many brands?
26,300.
Statewide,
yes. There's about 6,000 East River. The bulk of the rest of them are West River. There are some owned by people in surrounding states that border South Dakota, or that the biggest batch of brands that we send out renewal notices for, there's 24 of them owned by a family in Colorado who run cattle in South Dakota.
Thank you.
Senator Bartling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do all livestock barns brand inspect, even in East River?
No, they don't.
It's just the West River or the...
There are five open markets in the East River: Harriet, Mobridge, Gettysburg, and Platte. I guess that's four. That are what we call open markets, and they have cattle come from West River into there on what we call a shipper's permit. They can call our office and get one, or stop at a shipper's agent, and they give them a piece of paper that gives the number of cattle, the brand on these cattle, and then they're free to take them to the sale barn for sale. If I could use that for a segue into one of our upcoming legislative proposals, we are also looking at the possibility of being able to use a shipper's permit to be able to come into an in-state open market to obtain an inspection. If somebody out in some of the areas, they've got a set of portable corrals, they put together a load of cattle, and because they're in portable corrals, the brand inspector is not able to take a very good look at these cattle. I mean, this is important. The brand is the title to those cattle. That shows that this person owns that animal. And we would like to be able to have them just obtain a shipper's permit, bring them into an in-state open market, one of the four that I mentioned, and be able to unload them and get an inspection to take them on either to another sale barn, say go to Mitchell or Aberdeen or whatever, or haul them to a feedlot or sell them to a different owner. And it would be advantageous in some areas where also, a person has two, he runs cattle in the West River area. He lives in the East River area, went over to pick up his bulls. The nearest brand inspector is 35 miles away. He's got to pay $1.60 to this brand inspector to have him drive 30 miles to and from, plus the mileage. It gets to be awfully expensive for a inspection. The alternative is just load them and go and hope you don't get caught. And with this, they could call into the office, get a shipper's agreement, stop in Mobridge or Gettysburg or Platte, get their livestock inspected, take them home. It's trying to make this as consumer-friendly as possible, making it a lot easier to be able to have people get their brand inspections.
Representative Dennert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe we're getting a little off base and some questions, Mr. Stearns, but I was just curious, when you said that the brand was the only verification of that animal, and I understand, West River, that is the ultimate, but I was just thinking about the livestock ID tag that we're talking, source verified, age and things. If a West River rancher uses that ID tag, that would be another source of ownership verification, would it not? Because isn't that ID tag is registered. I mean, my son gets a bulk of them, or, you know, and they're recorded in his name. Am I just verifying it?
But that's true.
But ID tag, source verified, age verified tag would suffice or be the same thing if you started reading numbers?
That's true. That's true. I guess we use the brand as a visual ID. The tags have to go through a reader or put them in a chute and read the numbers on there and do some comparison. The brand serves as a visual ID for those animals that are out in the pasture, say in the West River area. East River is not as big a deal, and I shouldn't say not as big a deal, because there are bigger pastures in the East River too, but the bulk of them are probably smaller pastures, smaller herds, as opposed to 300 head of cows out in a 5,000-acre pasture.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. I appreciate your time and information this morning. I always learn something new when you're here.
That's good. Thank you. Good luck with the session.
Thank you.
Divide by four.
Divide by four. Well, with that, let's move down to the bottom of the agenda and we'll pull something up. Let's work on... Want to use the air... Which one do you want to do first? Should we do the Department of Revenue contract with SDSU?
Yeah.
All right, let's work on the Department of Revenue contract with SDSU. And I don't believe we have anything online for that.
I can just
comment. Sure. Tim will comment for us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I sent Department of Revenue Joan Serfling an email asking the GOAC committee had a follow-up question as to the ongoing nature of this contract. And if you recall, this was the contract that Department of Revenue entered into with SCSU to establish a database for the productivity value of the land by county. And it is their intention to, going forward, to continue with this contract to keep this database updated. It'll be a general fund contract annually. That's about it on that one.
Any questions on that? I am curious if it's going to be just built in. It was a special appropriation a couple years ago. I wonder if it'll be built into the general fund budget or if it'll be a continuing add-on special. We'll have to ask the Department of Revenue. All right, appropriators, remember that question. All right, let's go to the next one. Let's go. Do we have the Department of Military and Veterans contract with the law firm?
I talked to Bill Rajinsky from the Military and Veterans Affairs gave us an update, and if you click on document number 9 or go to document number 9, you can see Military and Veterans Affairs response to GOAC's follow-up question. Apparently there's still some issues with respect to this roofing project that they're not satisfied with, and then going forward, Military and Veterans Affairs is planning to contact the Attorney General's office on in determining who will legally represent them in issues.
Did they ever give you any inkling as to why they didn't go with the Attorney General's office, why they hired an external law firm? Okay. Another question when they come before appropriations. Okay. We might as well stay on our little roll here. Department of Transportation, the report on their airplane usage and loans to the regional railroad authorities.
Hopefully this communication from Secretary Bergquist answered the questions that the GOAC had at the last meeting. You'll see at the bottom of his letter there are the fuel costs by fiscal year on that report. That was a request. Aviation fuel prices and average price per year, state fiscal year. And then they have at the committee request shown both the dollar value of of the usage, state plane usage, is and the totals at the bottom. And then in addition, they have the hours of usage in the on the third page of that spreadsheet from DOT.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When I looked at this, when I seen like the governor's office, and it went up by about $1,000, but his hours is way down. So is it costing us an awful lot more to fly those planes on less hours?
I'm not sure, but as I'm looking at that with you here, and you're right, I'm not sure.
Because, I mean, he cut the hours quite a bit, but the cost actually went up a
little bit. Senator Haverly has some insight here, maybe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not that this is the answer to that, but there's routine maintenance that may take place in one year versus another year, or major maintenance that may take place in one year versus another year. And I don't know if that would be part of that, but it could. That's
probably when it really jumped out at me as far as,
If I could, that's just another question we'd ask at the appropriate time. But that was one of the things I noticed in that.
Because, yeah, I would agree. My understanding is they've got a standard hourly rate that they charge per aeronautical mile or something to that effect.
But they have different planes with different rates. Maybe that comes for it. If they're not flying the King Air, if they are flying the King Air.
Okay.
And that could be, but it's still, they must have been, flying it more before to have gone up with the hours decreased, the number it is,
The cost went up $1,000, and then the hours went down almost 25 hours. So we'll get a clarification on that. Anything else that stands out?
Madam Chair, the only thing that stands out to me is, and maybe with all of the presidents and changing is the real big jump in the Board of Regents. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe we'll just clarify that. They went from 29,000, 27,000 up to 69, and their hours, went up basically accordingly. But it looks like a quite excessive change from the Board of Regents. Are you taking notes for these?
Sure. You got them. Okay. Senator Bartling.
I would just, I guess the one for revenue and regulation, too, seems to be quite an increase of 59 hours to 129.
Okay.
And I guess I'm not sure what program or project they may be working on that would have required a lot of plane usage.
Okay. Any other questions on this? Okay. I guess we'll just be in a... Finn's going to comment on one other item here.
And the last attachment was the committee requested loans to the regional railroad authorities, and you'll see a list there. This is actually page 4 of 4 of that attachment, which has a list of the loans, the original loan amount, and the balance of the loan as of November 30, 2009, and kind of a description of what the loan proceeds were used for. With these PDF documents, we really can't change them once we get them, so we just put them out there.
Are there any questions on the outstanding loan balances? Senator Bartling.
Perhaps a general question is some of them that are the older loans out there at 2001, 2002, how quickly do those expire? What's the length or term of those loans? It does look like they're getting their loan balances down somewhat.
First one is just about paid off.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering what the length or term of those notes
yeah,
are.
I think we talked about this last year or maybe even the year before, and I think they're close to 10-year loans is what my gut is. Now, that may be wrong, and the DOT will probably send us an email clarifying that, but my understanding was is they were 10-year, and there were other terms as far as depending on what the project was. But I think the standard was 10-year, and the interest rate was... They had some goofy calculation. I'm not sure. I can't remember off the top of my head, but we've looked at that, too, I think. Maybe it's been 2 years now. They've got a calculation. Senator Haverly.
So, and another question, and I don't know who's going to answer, or somebody will probably ask these of the rail authority. Is that what's going on with this? Do they get the loan amount approved, and then do they draw down out of an account? I mean, that's what it appears like, because the 2009 ones haven't been touched yet. So obviously they're just waiting for something to happen to where they start to draw that money out. Is that how you...
I think they sent out the money already. I mean, they sent out, like, the last loans for, what, $2.6 million or something. I think they've sent the money out. I think there's the railroad... I think this is a part of the... This was all done... Let me get out the blue book here. We were looking at the other funds and getting clarifications on the funds. It's on the Railroad Trust Fund, Company 3044, on page 185. That money has the loans, and they issue the loans out of there. So the last loan would have probably just been issued, or the last agreement would have been just issued. The money would have just been lent out. So these regional railroad authorities have a taxing ability, and they collect the property taxes, essentially, and then the loans are paid back through that taxing authority, is my understanding. Is that consistent with the rest of the committee's understanding of the system? Make sense?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think that probably answers my question.
Senator Bartling.
Just wondering if there's a typo about halfway down the page. The benefited facility is DM&E and Verizon Aurora. The loan amount is significantly lower than the loan balance. I'm just wondering if there's a typo there. The loan amount was $149,000 and the loan balance is $1.3 million. So I'm just wondering if it's just a typo on their part, most likely.
I'm guessing. Let's talk to them.
All right. Thank you.
I think they're missing a zero. Any other questions? Got a quiet group today. All right. Well, we'll wait for the Department of Correct, or no. Oh, we've got Bob. Is Bob here? There's Bob. Bob, do you want to come up? We're going to talk about the supplement to the Blue Book. He went and created for us a nice little supplement from 1231, so we could see probably a change between the June 30 and 1231 and get the most updated information for session.
Bob Christensen with Legislative Audit. Yeah, that'd be about it. I use the state accounting system for December 31st, and for all the other funds, I've included the attachment here with the balances that were existing on the accounting system at that month end. And I've got them in here by the company number, and that, and it also has the page number in the blue book, so I thought that'd probably be the easiest for you to go go back and forth in that, because most people probably be working off the blue book and that. So if you look at that page, you should be able to get to what the December 31st balances are. Again, these are cash basis numbers, so it's like looking at your checkbook. It's what cash came in, what cash went out as of December 31st. Agencies should have condition statements or be able to provide condition statements that would have what their plans are for spending that during the year. So if they do have some major encumbrances or projects that they're going to be working on that's going to be spending down cash, they need to provide that to you and be able to discern that from looking at this information necessarily. There's also possibly some balances in the funds where there's a statutory distribution. One that I noticed looking through here was in the securities operating fund. It's company 3183, where securities money come in and are distributed out once a quarter. And there's $13 million in that fund at the end of December 31st. So I would anticipate that in January, early in January, that fund would be swept to the general fund. The law is that they sweep it once every quarter and leave only $15,000 in that fund. So that's, again, something that you have to take into consideration when you look at these.
Senator Hunoff.
Thank you. For my simplistic mind, let's just walk through one of these so you can give an explanation. Go to page 32, take the Board of Nursing, first one there. You've got the yellow lines, everything. Let's just walk down that column.
Where is she at? Which page are you on?
32.
Page.
First one, Board of Nursing. Okay, so walk down and let's...
Okay, the cash pool to state treasurer, that is the balance that's being invested with the State Investment Council. Cash and cash equivalents, that's showing a negative $53,000. Now, that would be what's in their local bank account. So perhaps they've written more checks than what they've deposited right now, or they haven't totally cleaned that up somehow through an accounting entry. Again, you will have that happen when you're looking at these interim months between July and June 30th when, you know, they look at these balances and get any type of transfers, cash transfers, whatever, cleared through the system. Accounts payable, there might be some vouchers out there that they processed at the end of December and that where... the check was written, but it hasn't actually been sent out yet, so it'll show basically accounts payable out there. It's not a completed document yet. Then the down below that would be your taxes and your expenses. So that's what was actually received and what was actually paid out to date. Transfers in and out. That's pretty self-explanatory in that. In some cases, they do transfer money internally, which would show up both as a transfer in and out. For the blue book at the end of the year, I try to eliminate those so you don't see those. You know, if there's a lot of coding that happens within these funds, and they'll show up as a net transfer in and out, which you'll see in this handout here, where there's the same amount transferred in and transferred out. Otherwise, it shows a net transfer out, which could be monies given to the probably Department of Health and that to administer it through some type of indirect cost assessment against the fund for handling the accounting for it. And then the beginning equity would represent what cash they had at the beginning of the year, and the ending equity should agree with what their net balances up above your assets less your liabilities.
Just one more.
Sure, go ahead.
Just back to the top again. You said that negative 53,000. What did you say that is?
That would be the cash in the local bank accounts. Now, the board requested that these funds that have local bank accounts try to maintain or try to update the state accounting system for the balances that they have in those local bank accounts, which I'm not sure if they do every month, but they at least Department of Health here has tried to maintain those. So it's possible that they might have overdrawn that local bank account, or just might be that they haven't processed a document to show what that actual cash balance is, because they haven't had the bank statement yet as of December 31st, because the cutoff's right at December 31st. So if they're running some of the expenditures in and they don't know what the bank balance is and it's just not updated yet.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bob, as I look at it, other than the one that Senator picked, the nursing shows an outstanding check or accounts payable. It looks to me like in the top section, you know, the numbers, in the bottom, jail and all of the stuff in the middle is just garbly goop to me. I mean, it's the process they have to go through. I mean, if you look at it, I mean, that will tell you the starting and the ending balance. Am I reading that somewhat right?
The ending balance is at the top. That's what the cash is they have in the bank.
Yeah.
There's probably not a whole lot on the down below the cash. There's probably not a whole lot of balances in there for any of the funds. But the reason that they're in there is some fund had a balance for loans, like such as the railroad trust fund would have like a loans receivable, or and some of the agency funds. Which is Company 8000, would have different types of liabilities where they're holding monies to distribute to cities for their portion of sales tax or the construction tax refunds or something like that.
And I don't mean to belittle all of the numbers. There's a lot of numbers and a lot of work. But I guess for me, the way I would look at this is the bottom line and compared to the year prior bottom line. You know, I mean, they've no doubt got authorization to do everything in the middle. And if we're seeing that growing or decreasing, that's where the questions would come in. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, yes. And again, you need to look at a condition statement to see what, you know, they might have plans for. If it's increasing, they might have plans. Or if it's decreasing, they might have plan to spend that down.
Yeah, thank you.
And I guess I just want to clarify the gobbledygook in the middle, the taxes collected or the revenues collected and the expenses coming out, that's all since July 1st, July 1st through December 31st?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah, I like gobbledygook. We'll have to use it more often. Any other questions or comments on this? Okay. Thank you. We better hold for just a moment. Sorry. All right. Welcome. Thank you very much for coming back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Tim Rice, and I've got Scott Bollinger here from the Department of Corrections. We were asked to come in and talk about two subjects, and I've handed out a a handout, an updated spreadsheet. I believe we sent a spreadsheet on the CISCON contract over to you previously, I think two meetings ago. You had questions, and we sent that over. And this is updated as of the 7th of January. It shows the payments that are made to date. And as you can see, there's a long list of deliverables when they signed the contract with CISCON in order to determine when you're going to get paid. It's based on what the product that they deliver. And so even though the deliveries do change as they go through a project of this comprehensive nature, it's not uncommon for there to be adjustments made, and that's been the case here, and we anticipate it'll continue to be the case. But kind of in the bottom line, if you go all the way to the back page, and I certainly don't mean to skip over, you can ask questions, but I think probably the committee's concern is the dollars associated with this project. And on the last page there, we've got a section called Project Cost Roll-Up, and the $4,904,940 is the contract amount. That is a little bit lower than the original contract. As I say, it kind of, we like it when things go down, not so much when they go up. But if you were keeping records, this is slightly lower than the very first contract that was proposed. And then you can see the items listed underneath there, and those items have been briefed to the Appropriations Committee in one fiscal year or another. Anytime you have a project like this, I guess we're just basing this on what we hear from other people who've undertaken these types of projects, is that you got to have a contingency, because inevitably you will find that there were misunderstandings or enhancements that come along as you develop over the course of the years of the project development and implementation, that if you don't have some money to pay for those, you're going to be surprised at the end and disappointed because you have not adequately planned. The next item there, subject matter expert overtime, etc. These are DOC costs. Again, there's a lot of work that goes on and has gone on. When these people come and they sit down and they start doing this programming, they'll grab the people that are subject, that know about the programming, the needs of the system. They'll sit down, they'll take them away from their job for days and weeks on end. As a result, it's not uncommon to incur overtime and those kinds of things. We've even had some limited cases where we've had to take someone off their job and then temporarily hire a backfill to do their job while they work directly on the CISCON project. It's been limited, and quite frankly, the overtime has been limited to date. We're going along, and things appear to be on task. I read about a lot of these projects and corrections over the years where the contingency went and the project cost doubled, and there were some real horror stories around the nation. So far, we're very happy with the way things are going with CISCON. The last two things, computer servers, hardware, other necessary hardware, $100,000, that appears to be very adequate at this point in time. And then the bit development costs are significant. There are a couple of bit programmers that are working full-time on it. And so that's where you get the total overall project cost of about $6.1 million. I would tell you that as far as project completion goes, originally when we embarked on this thing some time ago, originally the project was going to be completely installed and implemented in July of 2010. Well, we're a little behind that, and that's probably to be expected. It's primarily due to when we sit down and you communicate with the provider on the front end, you tell about how things work. They make certain assumptions, and they've got packages that they've done in other states like this. And I think, quite frankly, just to really summarize it, I think that there's the way we run corrections was more sophisticated than what they gave little old South Dakota credit for. And we had laid that all out up front, and they probably didn't do the diligence on it. And so it's taken them a little bit longer to modify their off-the-shelf package so that it falls in line to what we've asked for to begin with. And so fortunately, on the upfront process, we did a pretty good job of documenting that, and so that they haven't been able to come back and ask for change orders and so forth. If you don't do that, of course, then all of a sudden it looks like it wasn't written into the bid specifications, but you want them to do this, and you never really asked for it to begin with. That's where you get into some costly change orders. And I'm not suggesting that there won't be some change orders, but so far, so good. But we're going to be a little bit behind schedule. You can see the lower right-hand corner shows that we've had some contract carryovers, which I know the committee is very aware of. Right now, implementation of the juvenile system is scheduled on December of 2010, and March of 2011, implementation of the adult parole systems. So originally, like I said, July of 10, and now we're into calendar year 11, a couple of months. And that may move up or back a little bit, too, as we go through this year. But they are a little bit behind. It's nothing that's alarming or that we feel is going to be problematic for the department. Other than that, and as far as carryovers, we're still in the range that we can effectively carry this project over without jeopardizing the appropriations that were given. So I guess that's it in a nutshell, subject to your questions on that
Senator
topic.
Teason?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In a paragraph or less, can you explain what you're getting with this package and how it changes and affects the way you're doing business now?
Certainly, Senator. This is an overall offender management system package that will take the place of dozens of databases that are currently in place that we use. Everything from date calculations for offenders coming to prison, when they're going to get out, when they're eligible for parole, the inmate banking system, all the accounts that the inmates have, telephone accounts, the commissary accounts, the accounting of that, the in and out of monies associated with the inmate accounts, parole, the PAT system, the juvenile community correction system, all the case notes associated with someone when they go out on parole, when they go out into the community as a juvenile, the adult institutional computer software system, where the inmates are at as they come through and they process into our prison system, where they go, the inmate files. It's pretty much soup to nuts, everything that we would use a computer system for to track offenders both in the institution and upon their release to the community.
So your current system, you have independent systems in each of your institutions, and this will give you a centralized system. Is that a fair statement?
It's centralized now to the greatest extent, but there's just a variety of different systems that they don't really work together with one another. There's a lot of they've kind of been stick built as time has gone on, and they've worked okay. And they were put together by in-house programmers and so forth, but they aren't at the they're at the 2010 level, and that's where we're going with this one.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I kind of got two questions here. The first one is this going to be a savings to money to us, or is this just something that you do to update what you've been doing?
Well, Representative, this isn't one of those that is going to save money. It could save lawsuits because our other system was so outdated that we're told that it could have crashed at any time, and then when you lose that data, you could potentially, whether it's date calculations or any variety of things, put yourself in a position where you just are not efficient, and so it's something that we were really required to do in order to maintain our operations. So it's definitely not going to be cheaper than the way we used to do things. It'll be much better. And there is going to be costs associated with maintenance of this particular system as well. So it's not to do, we were really forced into it, bottom line.
And my second question, if I could, Madam Chair, is, and I probably should know this from past having, but I, you know, there's a lot of things to remember I don't always remember. Where does this funding come from? Is this general fund dollars? Is this federal fund dollars to help do this? Or where does the funding come from this for this?
I'm sure. If you look at the last page again, the lower right-hand corner, that's just a quick roll-up of where the okay. dollars have come with, from so far.
Okay.
And there hasn't been, you know, we've been fortunate. We had the original $500,000. We had some carryover, contractually obligated carryovers there in 8. And 09, we had other funds. The Appropriations Committee authorized other fund appropriation in 09 and 10. And when you see us present our budget in 11, the $1.2 million that was other fund appropriation in 10 will come out then, because that will be the last of the appropriated dollars for this particular
If I
project.
Could follow up, just when you talk about the other funds, what other funds are they that you're using?
It's been a variety of funds. Maybe I'll let Scott address that, because I've got him right here.
Representative Berg, the department has cash resources as a result of work release revenues that we charge inmates, the $18 a day. When they're based out of our facilities, we collect that $18 a day. And we've also got monies that we charge them that for commissary proceeds. When they buy their commissary, we do get a profit off that. We're applying those monies here. Community service, when inmates are out on community service, there's a 75 cent per hour surcharge that we take those monies and we're applying towards these projects. Those are some of the major sources that are funding this.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Hanoff.
You alluded to the fact you're behind on the project. What's contributing to being behind?
Senator, primarily it has been the contractor thinking that their off-the-shelf package would satisfy the requirements of the way we operate our offender management systems, and then finding out that it was a more sophisticated nature involved, whether it's date calculations or whatever. And so that's kind of in a nutshell. That might be an oversimplification, but they thought that they would be able to move through some of these modules a little quicker, and they were a little more complicated than what they had originally estimated when they developed the original timeline.
Then just a follow-up. So when you awarded the bid or the contract to that group, had that been piloted other places, or are you saying that they have a common generic and then they tailor it to the organization? And did you – it's late in the game here, but did you – visit other sites where this had been piloted, and what the time frame for implementation and installation was on those other whatever you reviewed?
Yes, Senator. We did visit, what was it, Nevada, or was it a couple of different states as kind of checking out their references, quite honestly. And they did check out okay. I think that Nevada, you'd think a state the size of Nevada would be really up to date, but what they found is that South Dakota is just the way we operate, and use of computers, reliance on offender management systems was quite a bit more sophisticated than the state of Nevada, and not so much in North Dakota. But we did check them out. Everything checked out good, and the quality appears to be very good. It's just going to take a little bit longer. Fortunately, we aren't into the change orders as a result of it. We've been able to show that the way the specs were drawn and the information that we gave them up front, we articulated our needs in a sufficient manner so that it didn't end up generating a change order.
Senator Haverly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Secretary, good morning.
Good morning.
Seem to see a lot of you, or at least hear a lot from you lately. So, yeah. When was the contract with Syscon, when was it official?
We signed that. Was that in fiscal year 08?
May of 2008.
May of 08.
Okay, and how much have we paid? I'm sorry, I have like several questions, Madam Chair. Thank you. How much have we paid him to date out of the initial contract of what was it,
4,904,940. Yeah. If you go to the first page,
okay,
the very far right column should be a running total.
1 point? Is that the 1 point?
Yes,
3?
That's correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then. You had mentioned several times that, I'm going back to several letters from earlier meetings that you had responded to by GOAC, that you all weren't very happy, at least at that point, with the progress that was being made by the contractor. You can answer that in a roundabout way, but have we done anything to implement basically what the contract is that we have with them to not pay them? Is that part of the reason why they're not getting any more money at this point?
Well, Senator, it really comes down to deliverables. It's spelled out in here. When you get this done, you get this money. And so it wasn't as a result of any dispute or anything with the contractor. It was the fact that it's taken a little long, and so they haven't been able to complete the various items identified in the deliverable column. And as they complete those and put those online, then they're entitled to bill for it, and then we will take care of it. To kind of try to answer a little bit of what it sounded like in the first part of your question, there was periods when we were kind of wondering how this was going to go, if it was going to be delayed unnecessarily, or if we were going to be able to work through all the kinks with the contractor. But that was probably one of the tones maybe was in an earlier letter to the committee. But I would tell you that things are going well. They kind of redesigned the people that they had assigned to the project. They brought in a few more upper-level folks to try to get things back on track. And as of right now, with the exception of the fact that the project is going to be, the implementation is going to be delayed beyond the very original timeline, we're satisfied with how they're doing.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, for that answer. And so you haven't had to take any further action as far as getting a hold of Syscon. You're just letting them do their gig now and try and get as far as you can. And I'll just finish this up with this last question. And you haven't had to pursue any other kind of contract or anything else with any other agent or any other group out there. You haven't started looking for anybody else since you're satisfied.
No, sir. This is we're in the boat with this company. And the dialogue is continuous. It isn't like they're working and then they send us some. They're working with our people every week, meeting on the phone every week, in person pretty much every week, continuing to do this because it's a very staff-intensive process where they are working across the table, at the table with us, pretty much straight through for the duration of this project.
Any further questions? Any further questions?
Is that all that's on the agenda? What's on that?
You got your hand raised. We can ask them if they got that in the book.
Okay. And it looks like we have a question on. Let's see. Look. I'll provide the committee with inmate trust fund financial statements. So we've got that in document 6. Can you walk us through that?
Madam Chair, do you have the 2009 June 30th, or is that?
I believe so.
You
yes.
Have it?
Yes.
Okay. I assume by walking through, you just want to hit the major categories that are referenced in the document itself. On page 1, if you look at under assets, the cash and cash equivalents, for the most part, that is the cash that's in the inmates' accounts. that are owned by the inmates. There are some cash equivalents that are holding accounts for us. As, let's say, an inmate is charged $18 a day for work release in January. We'll accumulate that through the month, and then at the end of the month, we'll submit a report off inmate banking that says inmate banking owes the state X number of dollars for work release. And we will in turn then cut a check to the state to say, here's that money for the work release. And so when you look farther down, when you go to June 30th, when you look at that $107,238, the due from other funds is really a lot of that kind of thing. There are monies owed from the inmates when they pay for stuff at commissaries, as another example. They will spend their $35 a week throughout the month. We'll take it out of their accounts as they use it, and then we will, in turn, when we get a bill from the vendor for commissary, we will pay them. But we'll collect it until it's due. And we'll do the same with work release. We'll do the same with fines that we issue to levy to inmates. If there are other costs, let's say they lose their ID, they get charged for that. If there's postage costs, that would be owed to the state that's incurred by inmates and so on. So those are the kinds of things that are in the due from other funds that would come into this account. And so you look at total assets of just over $2 million. Looking at liabilities, on the flip side, we also owe the inmate banking system on a monthly basis. Inmates that are accruing their 25 cents an hour for inmate wages, at the end of the month when we go to pay them, we put it in their account, but then we have to go back to the state account that it came from, maybe the state pen, Yankton, wherever, that incurred those inmate expenses. We owe the banking system for what we put in the inmates' accounts for that monthly work that they did. And so those are the kind of things that come on the flip side, on the liability side. But ultimately, when you get down to the bottom, there's roughly $2 million in the bank, majority of which is inmate money, not state money.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, if some of these old child support or anything like that, will you take money out of their account then to pay for that if they get kind of an excess amount or anything?
Representative Berg, without going into a very lengthy description of our inmate financial responsibility policy, directly to answer your question, if they owe child support, they owe restitution to the counties, court-appointed attorney's fees, those kinds of things, we do collect from inmates that have the money available to do so. Typically, the guys that are and women that are paying those types of costs are either out on work release and they're making a decent wage and so on, and those that are in private sector prison industries typically have money. On occasion, we do get family members who want to assist their family member who's in prison. They'd like to get that behind them so that as they approach release, when they walk out the door, they don't really owe anybody any money. And so occasionally that does happen. But we have a very elaborate, what I would consider fairly elaborate process to collect money from inmates. I think since we put this in place back in 1996 or seven, between child support and back to the counties and so on, for fines, court-appointed attorney's fees, restitution, I think we've turned back like $3.7 million from inmates.
Senator Teason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you characterize for me the approximate size of inmate accounts? I mean, I presume we're talking about a lot of accounts that have $10, $20, $50, $100. Do we have accounts in the thousands of dollars that inmates have? And how would we have large accounts for inmates? How would that happen?
Senator Teason, to answer your question, when you look at, on the average, we've done this in times gone past. On average, most inmates on average have in their account anywhere from $20 to $30 a month. But you're talking a very large share of inmates who are only making a quarter of an hour or making nothing at all, especially those that are in segregation for whatever purpose, mental health issues, can't work, those kinds of things. But we have had inmates that have made a large sum of money and paid all their debts that we were aware of while they were incarcerated. An example was we had a drug offender who, despite his drug offense, was a heck of a car salesman. And so when he went on work release, his employer wanted him back in the worst way because the guy could sell cars. And I think we paid out to him somewhere around $17,000 when he walked out. But all obligations that he had that we were aware of through the court were paid off. But most of your guys that are going to have any money of any substance are either on work release or they're coming through the private sector prison industry. Some of those guys that work for Metalcraft are making $15 an hour after they've gotten some experience. And so those are the guys that are paying and accumulating money because the guys that are over in Jameson are going to be there a long time. And so if they work a couple of years for Metalcraft, they'll get their obligations paid off typically and have a sum of money. But a lot of those inmates, and it's kind of interesting, a lot of them try and send a lot of money home too. Part of the formula for those that remember on private sector prison industries, we take 30% of their gross wage for cost of incarceration. We take 6% that goes into what we call a PS family or a family support account within the inmate's account. And it's up to him to decide if he wants to send it out and where it gets sent out. But it has to be specific to his family. And then they also pay 6% for victims count. And we pay that directly to social services out of their accounts. So there are a number of them that accumulate money, but they also send it out for family purposes and those kinds of things.
Representative Dennert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Secretary, back to the CISCON contract and things, and Representative Berg asked you about saving any money or FTEs, and you said no, we was kind of not forced or badgered but bullied to go into the system, but it was kind of mandatory. And then you did mention about the ongoing expense. I think you just touched on it briefly. Is the ongoing expense going to exceed what it's costing us now to keep the records? And you talked about a possible lawsuit. I mean, and I can understand that. So is our ongoing expense going to be comparable to where it is, or do you anticipate an increase in something that could increase into the future?
Representative, the ongoing cost will be quite a bit more than what we had been paying in the past. Qualifying that by saying our past expenses were virtually nothing. We had a full-time DOC employee, Harry Christensen was his name, and he was the guy in coordination with and in cooperation with the BIT people who maintained our system. BIT and Harry did it. And now Harry is retired, and Kim Edson is now the information manager for the Department of Corrections. We've got the one person who, we've got a fairly large department, and she is the information management guru for the department. She works closely with the BIT folks. But the nature of the reason why we hung on to the old system as long as we did is because we could do it for basically with a couple of people tinkering with it as it went along, and we held on to that thing as long as we dared, quite frankly, until we couldn't get the software that it was using in order to. We had some choices. We could try to migrate to a different type of software to try to do the same kinds of things that we had been doing, but nobody would guarantee that we would not lose information as that migrated. Nobody could look us in the eye and say, we can do all the things that you're doing now by putting in this new software. And we needed to be able, we could not afford to risk the information and how it might impact the department, how it might impact an offender who didn't get released on time and those kinds of things. And so we were pretty much out of options at that point in time. We could have continued to try to nurse the thing along in its present form. Everybody told us, don't do it. It's going to crash. And you see how many years it takes to put in a new system, so that would have been ill-advised to go that route. And so we said, well, the time has come. Everybody else has pretty well been there. We waited as long as we could, and so we're going there now. But as is the case, doggone it, even I think back when I was sheriff, and we'd be doing things a certain way, and then all of a sudden we had to step up and become current, and you'd buy a software package, and it was much smaller price tag than what we're talking about here. But all of a sudden then you had the costs associated with maintenance, upgrade of the software packages, because they will upgrade every few years, and that's an ongoing expense, and so it's going to cost more. It's going to clearly cost more than we ever had to pay before. We're going to have a much more certainly reliable system, more sophisticated system, a system that talks to each other. The old days of having Harry come up and program a little way so you could do something, those days are over, and they're never coming back, and it's going to cost us more to do business this way. But it'll be a much better system.
Senator Hanoff.
Thank you. Just for my information, do these numbers, do we operate the same way, and is this system will impact the women's prison system also? Are there numbers in this numbers here? Do they have a similar system?
Are you back on the inmate
accounts? Yes.
Senator Hanoff, the inmate financial responsibility and this inmate banking
one vaccine, and then also the recent recalls of the vaccine. So we've got Secretary Hollingsworth here. So I'll ask you to come forward and give us a brief you must have a brief presentation for us on this. So awesome. And Maggie, can you hear us all right?
I can. It's terrific.
Perfect.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Donnie Hollingsworth. I'm the Secretary of the Department of Health, and with me is Colleen Winter. She's the Director of our Division of Health and Medical Services. We could talk to you about H1N1 for hours today if you'd like. nobody's shaking their head affirmatively. We do appreciate the opportunity to update you on our efforts. It's really absolutely been the dominant public health and private health care sector issue that we've dealt with since the legislature adjourned back in March. I think it's been a very successful effort in South Dakota. We've had fantastic support from private health care providers, from communities, from counties, from volunteers. It's taken a tremendous amount of planning. We started planning. We had to respond at the end of April when the first cases appeared in America, and very shortly thereafter, within about a week in South Dakota, but we started planning for what will we be facing, and really lots of unknowns. We were told at a national H1N1 summit back in early July, the feds asked every state health agency to come, and there were the leaders of the CDC and HHS and education and Homeland Security, and they said, if you leave here with one message today, it's prepare to be surprised. We're going to tell you everything we know today, and we want you to plan based on that. And we're going to keep telling you everything we know. But this is a novel virus. It's an emerging issue, and it's very dynamic. And so that's how we had to approach this, was really prepare to be surprised. And that was a good motto, a good lesson, as we prepared to deal with it. You've specifically asked us to address the vaccine distribution and recall, and vaccination was a huge component of our H1N1 planning and response. But I just want you to know that there were many other components, certainly. Surveillance, including lab testing, the department did over 9,000. We tested over 9,000 samples for H1N1. Coordination and communication with healthcare providers, with schools, with childcare, with local governments, with state agencies, all that was certainly also part of our efforts. And as the vaccine was being developed, and CDC isolated the strain of the virus in early May and began asking manufacturers to start developing the vaccine right away, there's been certainly a fair amount of criticism about how long it took to get the vaccine in place, how long it took to get to states, the components of the vaccine. There have been congressional hearings on the issue, but really, if you step back and think that from early May, when they first started to isolate the virus to build the vaccine, until the end of September isn't very many months. It's about 5.5 months. And in that time, a brand new vaccine was developed. And by the end of September, states were beginning to receive their first doses. All we could affect was once the vaccine got to our state. We couldn't get it here any sooner, although we would have liked to. We couldn't get us any more, although we would have liked to. But once it got here, is what certainly we're responsible for, and we're happy to describe to you what happened. I should also remind you that all of the vaccine was purchased by the federal government. They contracted with 5 manufacturers, the same manufacturers who make seasonal flu vaccine, and those same manufacturers ramped up, and at the same time they were making seasonal, or shortly thereafter, they started making H1N1 with a lot of scrutiny over their process. And so no one, the vaccine was free. States didn't pay for the vaccine. It all came to us. And certainly at a private provider's office, the provider could charge the patient an administration fee for the vaccine. But the intent of the federal government continues to be access for all Americans, starting with the priority groups, to get the vaccine. The second slide is a diagram of when I say priority groups. Last summer, based on the experience of the disease from April forward, the CDC and the ACIP, ACIP is the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, developed priority groups of who should be the first to get the vaccine. And that was all based on the which populations were affected the most adversely from the disease. So the pie chart shows you the percentages of the risk groups in South Dakota, and then the columns to the right of that give you numbers. For instance, there's 12,200 pregnant women in South Dakota last year, and it breaks it out by the tier group. So pregnant women, caretakers of infants less than 6 months, children 6 months to 4 years of age, and then children up through 18 who were high risk, who had health conditions, and healthcare workers. Those were the first group, the first tier. The second tier was the rest of the kids, basically children who didn't have, children 5 to 18 who didn't have health conditions, youth 19 to 24, and then adults 25 to 64 with health conditions.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you talk about these numbers, and then there was, I think there was something out there where certain age groups or certain people needed a second vaccination. I don't know if you'll get to that later or not.
I can answer that question right
but
now.
But how has the people that need the second shot, have they stepped up and gotten it, is my question.
For the most part, yes. And the people that needed two doses were basically children under 10. And that was just based on the clinical trials that these young people needed two doses to be adequately protected. And the first of that group, the kids up through 4 years of age, were in our very first tier, so they started getting the vaccine at the end of October. And many of them, most of those, have come back and gotten their second dose. There have been multiple opportunities for those second doses in clinics, private clinics, and also in public clinic events.
Hey, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Page 3, when you asked about planning or distribution, the chart that's labeled 3 is really, I think, our best description of how we planned to roll out our vaccination campaign. And it was based on the tier groups and the venues, the opportunities that we would provide for those priority populations to get the vaccine. For instance, pregnant women could, we thought, well, they're going to generally get a shot in our offices, health department offices, or at their private provider's office. Typically, a pregnant woman's not going to stand in line at a public clinic event as much. But then there were more opportunities for the parents or the caregivers of infants. If you just follow that all the way through, what we were trying to do was have a plan that was scalable. We could scale it up or down based on how much vaccine we got. And we knew that was going to be a question from the beginning. When would we get it and how much would we get? Unfortunately, we ended up scaling back way more than we ever scaled up, because we learned to expect that what we were told to plan on next week, was the doses were never as high as what we were told to plan on. And so we ended up just planning on less, and that made it a lot easier. Really, until about the third week in December is when it kicked into gear more, and you'll see those numbers. But our goal was to have multi-layers of opportunities. Once they were in the target group, and of course we wanted to do the entire population once we had enough vaccine, and that ended up being about the middle of December. But giving them opportunities at their private provider's office, but also public opportunities. And this grid was something we started working on in the summer, made many changes throughout the fall, but really from October forward, it's how we, in a very simple way, moved forward with this. While we were making our plans, I think it's important that you just have a few graphs that show you what happened with the virus. What was our experience in South Dakota? And that's what about the next four of them do, and I'll go through those very quickly. But the H1N1 virus took hold in South Dakota and everywhere else in America, and really ramped up, especially in the fall. The chart on the page 4 shows the confirmed cases. These are laboratory confirmed cases of H1N1 by week. And so this is what we call our epi curve. It really shows the experience and when it happened. You can see that really throughout the summer, almost every week, we had a few cases. It started to ramp up in September. In October, it just exploded. And from about the third week in October since, it has continued to decrease in South Dakota. These are just confirmed cases. That's just the tip of the iceberg of the actual disease, the prevalence of disease that was out there. But it's a very good way to track what's going on. A lot of people didn't get tested. Some people didn't even see a doctor. or the physicians made presumptive diagnosis because H1N1 was the almost the only virus that was out there.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In looking at this graph and seeing how it's tailed off, do you feel a lot of that is just that it kind of ran its course, or did you think that the actual vaccination really kicked in and really brought it under control?
I think it's some of both, Representative Berg. Certainly couldn't take, vaccination can't take entire credit.
That's what, you know, that quickly, I would, you know.
No.
But I don't know that much about these things either. So.
Right.
It's probably going to be easier to start saying, Madam Chair, because I'm going to have to do that all through appropriations now, too. So,
we needed the vaccine. This graph clearly shows that we needed the vaccine before we had it. We didn't have very adequate supplies at all when our cases were skyrocketing. Page 5 is, I think, is a good illustration. This is what happened as far as within the various age groups, deaths, hospitalizations, and confirmed cases. And our data is very similar to the national data and other states, but this really helps to affirm those priority groups that were established by CDC. 69% of our confirmed cases were in people under 19, and 48% of our hospitalizations. The brunt of the disease was felt by young people. The chart on page 5 is just something that we watch very closely in an outbreak, and certainly this was an outbreak of pandemic proportion, but we watch hospitalizations and deaths very closely, and healthcare providers were fantastic partners in getting us information very quickly, doing reports to us so we could keep track of what was going on and looking at it from the statewide level. But this certainly shows that hospitals in South Dakota were very busy. And when people were hospitalized with H1N1, they were very sick. Many of them were in ICU. They were on ventilators. And unfortunately, 23 South Dakotans passed away from H1N1.
Madam Chair, now, I just got my H1N1 maybe a week ago or 2 weeks ago, but I also tried to get my flu shot at that time, and they were out of the vaccine, and they said they didn't think they were going to be getting it again. I regret it now because I did have an opportunity to get it earlier, but I didn't, you know. You know, I'm not that concerned about it, I guess, but, I mean, is part of the reason why are we running short on the regular flu vaccines, you know, or is it a tough point of where maybe we put the priority over here and didn't put this prior?
What I'm told, Representative Berg, is that nationally the amount of seasonal flu vaccine that was manufactured and distributed is almost exactly what it was last year. But this year there was a very high demand for seasonal vaccine early in the season with all the talk about H1N1. Before H1N1 vaccine was available, people came out, people who've never been interested in a seasonal shot before wanted it. And then there was a lull there in about November where seasonal vaccine was hard to come by. Now, since December, it's improved quite a bit. And if you want a seasonal shot, I think we can find a place I would hope we can find a place that where you could get that. And just quickly on page 7, this is, I think, a very compelling graph. This shows the historical data of influenza cases in South Dakota, and it tracks it by month from the various seasons since 2004 up to 2009 and 2010. And you can see that the solid red line, which is 2009-10, almost entirely H1N1, came at an unprecedented time. We had those cases very, very early, summer and fall, and typically flu peaks in February and March. Just a good indication, again, of how unusual this was, that we're dealing with a novel virus. And we can't predict what's going to happen in these next few months when It's typically the peak of influenza. Are we going to see another peak of H1N1? There are certainly some experts that suggest that. Or are we going to see seasonal flu take off? We haven't seen it yet. So we're really watching what's going on here. Certainly the World Health Organization and CDC, private providers and public health are paying close attention to what could happen in the coming months. I hope that slide 8 gets at your question of allocation and distribution of the vaccine in South Dakota. It shows by week the number of doses every, almost daily, South Dakota would get, our immunization manager would get a notice from CDC of our allocation for the day for the next 2 days. And we would immediately order whatever we were allocated. And we made the decision back, in July, that all vaccine that was allocated to South Dakota would come to Pierre, to the health department, and then we would break it down because the smallest unit that they would send from the federal government, from the various manufacturers, was 100 doses. Well, we knew, we expected we'd be dealing with small amounts initially. We've got lots of providers, and if we had 100 doses that would go out, there would be places that would get shorted often, or we'd be doing every other week. And so I think looking back, that was a very, very good decision. It was a tremendous amount of work, and our staff did an awesome job. The vaccine would come in to us on a Monday. It was always out by Tuesday or whatever day, always out the next day. Often the same day. We used a courier system to send a lot of the vaccine out to providers. We distributed it to these enrolled providers, which are listed on this sheet, including almost 300 clinics, 52 hospitals, long-term care, pharmacies, the Indian Health Service, and just a variety of others. But this shows you, I think, that the vaccine definitely trickled in. We never had as much as we wanted. And this forced us to even sub-prioritize within, especially Tier 1 at the beginning. The first couple weeks, we said that the vaccine needs to go to healthcare workers, and those healthcare workers that are at the tip of the spear, those that are providing care at the bedsides of people who are sick, those who are vaccinators. By about the third week in October, we started sending some of the vaccine to clinics, and saying, based on your best medical judgment and hospitals, please provide this vaccine to your patients who could use it the most. Pregnant women, sick children. I mean, but the healthcare providers are the best ones who could judge who needs these very limited doses the most. It was the end of October, that week of the 26th, before we started doing public clinic events. That week we just had a few. And then really ramped that up as more vaccines started. For your information, we stayed with Tier 1 through on November 6th, we started Tier 2, so expanded the eligibility, and December 11th, we expanded to Tier 3, which is basically the entire population. And it's not coincidental that expansion to Tier 3 happened at the same time that we got more vaccine than we'd ever had, almost 86,000 doses. That was our big week. At that time, though, back then, we were still seeing demand exceeding supply. And we were still, and how we allocated it, how we sent it out to these 400, 500-plus providers was based on, they would tell us about how many patients that needed the vaccine in these tier groups. And our denominator changed every week based on how much vaccine we had. Nobody ever got what they asked for, but they got a percentage. And just now, within the last couple weeks, we're actually hearing from some providers who are saying, we don't need any more. Don't send us any more. We've taken care of the pregnant women and the kids in our practice. and with the things that are going on publicly, we don't need any more. But we're still pushing it hard and hoping that South Dakotans continue to get their shot. As of this week, we have just over 400,000. We will have a cumulative total of just over 400,000 doses. That's more, that's significantly more than any amount of, or any year of seasonal flu doses that we've ever had. So it took a long time, but we worked hard to make our allocations fair, to spread it from border to border, from provider to provider. And I can't say enough good about healthcare providers in South Dakota. Slide 9 gives you the logos of especially our public clinic partners, Avera Health, Regional Health, and Sanford Health. We contracted with them to help us do public clinic events all over the state. Also in Sioux Falls, we worked closely with the City of Sioux Falls, their health department. Just ongoing events from border to border in large communities and small communities in schools. And while these public clinic events are happening, the private sector is taking care of patients, too. They're giving us staff to help with public events, but they're also seeing unprecedented volume of patients coming into their clinics and ERs. So the coordination and the communication was fantastic. I remember when we were talking to our partners in the healthcare community this summer about this and planning, we talked about how important it was that the health department and the private sector were speaking with the same voice, that we would have a mess on our hands if the health department was saying, we need to focus on priority groups in Tier 1, and then we had healthcare providers in a few communities who were just giving the shot to anybody. That did not happen here. We had excellent support as we moved along the priority groups, and I do think that healthcare spoke with one voice in South Dakota, and that didn't happen everywhere. So that really helped us. And the public really was, surely there were people who wanted their shots before they could get them. But for the most part, people were very patient. They understood the rules, and they followed by those rules. But these pictures are some great, the pictures on 9, I think, show some public events. And I would point out for you the one in the middle, it's hard to tell what that is. But what that is, it's the mobile clinic that was purchased with federal dollars through CMS. Social Services wrote this grant to expand access to health care outside of emergency rooms. And this clinic has gone all around the Pine Ridge Reservation, doing what it normally does, but also giving H1N1 and seasonal shots. And so actually CDC noted this practice as a best practice and something that other states should follow.
I've got a couple quick questions. Representative Dennert, did you still have a question? And then we'll go to Representative Berg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Secretary, the numbers, 400,000 doses that you received is 50%, and you indicated that there is some places that have said don't send us anymore. Is that about the normal figure, about 50% of the people are going to get the shot, either in seasonal or even in this outbreak? Is that kind of where we're at now? And are the second shot numbers included in that 400,000, and how many was there of those?
The second dose for the people under 9 are included. The 400,000 is the total doses that have been provided to South Dakota. 50% of the overall population is probably a little higher than what normally we would get for seasonal flu. We're still getting more vaccine in. We're asking for our allocation. We're planning events. If you looked at our website, the planned events through the month of January, there's lots and lots of them throughout the state. So we're hoping, just because disease has waned for now, you know, that graph that showed, we don't know what to expect. There's plenty of vaccine available. People should take advantage of it and get their shot.
Go ahead.
The seasonal flu is just what it said. You said more seasonal. And I know we have deaths from that one, too. Mm-hmm. But do you anticipate the H1N1, like you said, we've seen it drop. We anticipate maybe an increase. Is this something that could be prevalent, you know, more not seasonal, more year-round? And will I have to have a follow-up or booster, you know, 8 months, 6 months, or a year from now?
That's a great question. I think it's very likely that H1N1 will be a component of the seasonal flu vaccine next season. And yes, you'll need a booster. We all will. The seasonal flu vaccine is it's called a trivalent. There's always three strains, two A's and a B. H1N1 is an A. The first week in February, the ACIP and the nation's immunology experts and CDC are meeting to determine which three strains will be part of the seasonal flu vaccine for the 2010-2011 season. I'm betting there'll be an H1N1 component in that.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you say that all these shots have been free, now, is the federal government reimbursing any money or the state to these providers that are given these shots, or are they just doing it free gratis?
The vaccine is free. Nobody paid for the vaccine. At the public clinic events, we actually are using federal grants to help pay for contract vaccinators.
Okay, so these providers or these people that are putting on it are getting paid in a different manner?
They are, but I would tell you that their efforts have been extraordinary. And at the private clinic level, those folks can charge an administrative fee. A lot of times they don't. I can tell you that. And a lot of those private clinics have offered opportunities for their patients to come in, do a clinic on Saturday. So when we talk about the public clinic events, that certainly is not the only picture of what's happened. And just the planning, the time that that the private sector put into working on this, there's a tremendous cost, a tremendous investment that they've made. And that's what they do. They have to respond to the disease that's out here, but I would never suggest that they've been compensated for their time or their resources that they've put into this.
So do they get compensated so much per shot or so much per event, or how do they do that?
At the private clinic, they would be able to charge for an office visit.
Yeah.
For a patient that they see. There's a maximum allowable that they can charge for the administration of the shot. But at the public events, we are still paying our contract vaccinators based on the number of vaccinators they're providing to us to assist with the events.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Gillespie, did you have a question?
I do. I've got a series of questions, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Secretary, for being here today and for your efforts and the efforts of your staff. I'm sure the response was incredible in your office, as you've indicated. My main question and concern, and the line of my questions concern the distribution issues with providers and the choice to have the public clinics. And so if I might, you know, I would like to preface my questions, Madam Secretary, just by telling you that I do have a 4- and 1-year-old. So I've been through the wash machine with this, and so some of my questions are just geared on my own personal experience. But I guess, you know, I was just wondering, I'll admit that my physician's clinic in Sioux Falls, was very busy. But I guess, you know, there were times that I guess my main question is, by the time my children were becoming eligible for their second shot, the tier system was basically opened up to more people. And my question is, you know, do you do you have any thoughts, or have you learned anything, and do you plan to change anything next year as far as that issue, when all of a sudden, you know, the children haven't had their second shot, but we're going to open it up, you know, to the general public?
Well, Senator Gillespie, what we were tracking, and we have an immunization management system that admittedly is behind, because at the height of the epidemic, we're not worried so much about entering data as just getting people shots and taking care of them. But we were watching very carefully the uptake of the vaccine as it was out in the provider groups in the priority groups based on the best data we had. And we didn't make the decision to move to the next priority groups until we'd reached a threshold where we thought 50% of a certain group, or, I mean, everyone we had different thresholds for, but we were watching that very carefully. We also had, and you can't see it, Senator, but I'll be happy to go through it with you when you're in peer, this matrix that showed there are multiple opportunities, not just at the private provider's office, but also in the health department offices, in public clinics, where people could get those shots. I honestly did not hear many complaints about people not being able to get a second dose for their children. At the beginning, very few people who wanted the shot could get it. It was like a funnel.
Mm-hmm. I understand that.
I don't think I answered your question.
Well, that's okay. And, you know, I'll take the punishment for wanting my shot delivered by my provider, because, you know, my children get multiple vaccinations, and I wanted, you know, the nurse or the physician to look at me and tell me, yes, this shot is okay with, you know, her, you know, Hib shot and all the other ones that she was receiving. So, and, you know, I'm one of those people, you've referenced the pregnant woman who doesn't want to stand in line. I didn't really want to stand in line with my 4 and 1 year old either, you know, but my main issue was I wanted the documentation, and I wanted, you know, that reassurance of getting the vaccination at the provider's office. And so I guess, you know, my question is, do you have any intention or plan, you know, to change anything next year, or maybe nothing will need to be changed if the shot's going to be incorporated in the flu shot.
Your comment, I would certainly never say that you should take the punishment, Senator, for wanting.
Oh,
no,
you
because,
know what I mean.
No, but as we were planning, that's what we were expecting, that there's some parents, that's the only place they're going to go to get their child vaccinated.
Right.
Others are going to stand in line for 2 hours at a public event. But so we were distributing it based on this ratio of spreading it out to as many places as we could, to as many people as we could throughout the state. And, yeah, it was basically uniform dissatisfaction. but I think we could show that it was fair. If anybody said, hey, you know, tell me what's going on here, and it's like, well, here's our denominator this week, and your clinic got 600 doses, and they're like, oh, well, that's fair, you know. And initially, especially when we were focusing on that first tier, we certainly didn't send it to long-term care. We didn't send it to pharmacies. We didn't send it to provider offices of, say, internists or orthopedists or any place like that. We were focusing it on OBGYN clinics and family practice clinics.
Sure.
And I know that this issue was raised in Rapid City, and we did some response to exactly your questions about, there was one clinic that wanted more vaccine. Give it to us. We'll take care of our patients, and don't give it to the public clinics as much. But when we did the ratio then, and that was probably about the end of October, it was the doses that we had, we'd sent 55% to the private sector and 45% to the public sector at that time. I could run a ratio for you, although I know that that has continued to increase to the public events, but it was a juggling act.
Oh, I'm sure, Madam Secretary, and I'm not trying to be overly critical of you, and I can't change what I lived. I mean, I can't change what, and I've talked to other parents, you know, as well, who, you know, we're all just trying to get through it.
Right.
I guess my question was simply, you know, if, and one of the other legislators asked you there, I forget who, as far as next year, did you state that, that the discussion is probably that the vaccine will be incorporated into the regular flu shot, or how do you anticipate that working? Could you repeat that?
Sure. Yes, the question, my answer is that it is, most experts believe that the H1N1 will be a component of seasonal flu vaccine next year. How that will be handled, I don't know. I mean,
right.
This year the federal government bought it all. That's never happened. Will they do that next year? That would be very unusual. But what we want to continue to do in South Dakota, what really helped us address this issue better this year than some other states, was our experience that we've had in schools and child care facilities, because this is, for the last two previous years, the state has purchased has purchased influenza vaccine for children in South Dakota, for all children. And so we have the experience of going into schools and child care facilities and also providing it, Senator, to health care providers so they can give it to their patients when they come in, but at no charge. So that experience put us way ahead of other states.
Sure.
They'd never even, I mean, the concept of going into a school and giving a shot in more than a handful of states never happened until this year.
Well, we certainly applaud you for your efforts, and that's all the questions that I had. Thank you for being there today.
Senator Teason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Based on your experience so far, are you aware of or are you concerned about any situations either in this state or nationally where the healthcare and scientific basis for the distribution policy has been trumped by bureaucracy or politics?
I absolutely don't think that happened here, and we carefully watched our allocation and how did that compare to other states every week. CDC was very transparent. I don't know how. Certainly health officers and health departments could see where the vaccine was going every week, what other states were getting, and we always did an analysis. Where are we? And consistently, we were third, fourth, or fifth percentage-wise in the country. And I think it's because we immediately ordered our allocation, we got it here right away, and we redistributed it. So I think we were treated fairly as a state. I did not see that happening nationally at all. And in South Dakota, absolutely, we distributed it, redistributed it, just based on the numbers that we had, and it was just a percentage of what they asked for every week, border to border.
Senator Hunhoff, did you have a question?
Yes, please. I have a couple, if I could, Madam Chair. Thank you. Again, I want to say thank you, and of course, we're involved in our area. Were there any lessons learned in this? Because I'll tell you what my challenge was. I think that as you started to have those clinics, you had a limited amount of doses, and people didn't come. So personally, I turned people away because they didn't meet the tiers. Two different messages were coming, one from an organization and one from the state, and they did not coincide as far as should this person be immunized or not. And so I'm concerned that was there anything learned, because I turned people away, and I feel really bad because at the end of the day, we had 300-plus doses left over. So that's one.
My second is, you alluded to Representative Berg about the compensation, and you did some things. I'm rather curious, and this is a State Department. The Human Service Center led the charge on the community one that we had. Whereas that department, were they reimbursed because they had a lot of their staff that were, and this is really an appropriation, but it is still an operational question that should be asked, were they compensated in some format for the hours that they put in for that?
Okay. I'll answer your last one first. No, they weren't. And if you go back to that matrix, is that right? That is right, isn't it? If you go back to that matrix on slide 3 that shows the various venues, PODs are right up at the top. And POD is an acronym that stands for Point of Distribution System, or Point of Distribution. And it's planning that's been in place actually since like 2004 for no matter what epidemic we're dealing with, how would we get an immunization, an oral pill, whatever treatment quickly to a large amount of people. And so PODs, we have PODs in like 30 different communities. And the one that the Human Services Center led in Yankton, that was a POD effort. And the PODs actually they've had some planning money to help put things in place, and they got some additional minimal amounts of H1N1 grant, but we didn't pay the volunteers at the PODs. They were not compensated. And there's lots of examples like what HSC did in Yankton throughout the state where community groups came together and organized those PODs. Your second question, or your first question, about different messages. Senator, I really felt like we were in sync very closely with the private sector about here's the tier group here's the eligible population for the events at this time. And I really heard very few instances where we said one thing and somebody else was saying something else. I know it was frustrating. If your example where you had a couple hundred, 300 doses left after one event, we were focusing on one tier group or another, and people got turned away, that happened rarely. Most times, especially early on, we ran out of vaccine, or we came very close to running out of vaccine. And so it was important that all of those events, we were trying to handle them the same way. So they weren't saying, oh, I'm an elderly person and I was able to get my shot in Elk Point, but you weren't able to in Yankton.
Are there any further questions? Senator Bartling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Secretary. I guess just a point of just comment, I'd heard some concerns about the distribution as well, based on the populations. And, of course, we know Sioux Falls, Rapid City, the mm-hmm. larger centers. In some of those earlier distributions, they received, you know, a minimal amount, yet some of the even smaller communities received about those same amount of doses for those tiers. And I think there's just some concerns as to the distribution plan and to the communication to the, whether that's in those public events or in the privates, as to how the distribution got placed out there. So I guess my focus then is, I don't think we've seen the end of it. You know, we know that there is the flu season as well ahead of us yet. Are there going to be some changes into the direction that the department takes to keep that communication open between not only the community health nurses throughout the state,
mm-hmm.
But to and I guess I think of the city of Sioux Falls and the massive amount of work that needs to be done through their departments there to meet those tiers and whatnot. Have you thought of changing some communication processes so that everyone is on the same page when it does come to distribution and who's getting what and when?
Well, we would certainly take into account, and we monitored based on population. We would not send the same number of doses to Tripp County that we sent to Minnehaha County or even close. We tried to watch that very carefully. But some of that was based on the number of providers in those counties and not just the number of people, but it's where people sought care. You're right, this isn't over, and we're encouraging South Dakotans while we have the vaccine to get their shots. I am not aware of a facility out there that's looking for more vaccine that doesn't have it. But if there is, they should contact us because we have it. Only in recent weeks do we have it, but we do. And so if there's places that need it for events that they have scheduled or for their own clinic, we'd love to get it out to them. And every week with the vaccine, we would send a note, a colored insert, that's like, here's what's going on this week. Here's our expectations. Also, we have what we call, it's called the Health Alert Network, but an electronic email communication system that goes out to, that includes the vaccine coordinator at clinic sites and at hospitals. It includes local officials. It includes other healthcare providers. We learned redundant communication. You think you're getting it to somebody, and you're not. The Appropriations Committee has asked us to talk about lessons learned. Certainly, I'm not here to tell you that everything we did was great and we'll do it exactly the same again. We'll be happy to spend more time with the Appropriations Committee about those lessons learned.
Are there any questions on the distribution? I think the other side was how did you deal with the recall?
Pardon me, I'm sorry.
How did you deal with the recall in December, I believe it was?
My name is Colleen Winter, and I'm the Division Director for Health and Medical Services. And we received two recalls for H1N1 vaccine in December. And we've given you a couple of handouts that are the Q&As off of CDC's website about those recalls. One of them was for a prefilled syringe for our 6 to 35-month-olds, and the other one was one of the nasal spray recalls. And really what we did, I think we have one slide that covers that, an overview on that. It's our very last slide. Just a little background. As a part of quality assurance for immunization programs, the manufacturer already performs routine testing and screening on the stability of our vaccine. And that's an ongoing testing. And they're looking at the potency of the vaccine. And sometimes after shipment of vaccine, potency can go down. What happened with both of these vaccines in general was that the vaccines were safe. They'd been tested. They were pure. They were good vaccines. But in some of the testing that happened down the road, it appeared that maybe their strength was slightly less than what the standard would have been. The companies, FDA, CDC, the National Institute of Health, all had opportunities to look at it and felt that the vaccine was still safe and that there was still adequate coverage for those who had received those doses of vaccine. Now, granted, some of those, a lot of those were children. They still did indeed need a second dose anyway as a part of the protocol, but that the vaccine still was effective. There is a number of vaccine doses that were recalled in the handout that you have. It was 1,000 doses of Sanofi and 17,200 doses of FluMist. What we did in South Dakota is all of the clinics were notified. We did know which clinics received which of those lot numbers. There was communication to them, and if they had doses left, they were asked to be returned to our immunization program in the health department, just as providers are instructed ongoing, provided the coolers and the supplies that they needed to return those vaccines.
Are there any questions? Any other questions on the H1N1 presentation? Senator Bartling.
Madam Secretary, did your staff go through any specialized training or anything when all of this started coming down? Did you have to do any training? I'm sure just to be, of course, come aware of it, but what did your staff have to go through?
That's a great question, and it's science on the move as it's being developed. But really, we in an instance like this or any emerging issue, we really would rely on CDC, like our counterparts in every other state. And the amount of information that was coming down, whether it was laboratory, whether it's epidemiology, whether it's surveillance, whether it's vaccine, those different parts of the department were all getting new and updated information all the time. We're trying to provide that to healthcare providers, the part that's pertinent to them. And actually, all of those parts, at least parts of them, are pertinent to the providers in the field, because even laboratory protocol, how we're doing our tests, but the people that are drawing the lab samples are out in the field in private clinics. So lots and lots of information, updates all the time. But it's still, it's influenza. And also another partner that I shouldn't exclude are the infectious disease physicians throughout our state, especially in Sioux Falls and Rapid City. Those folks help us review information and help get information to the private sector what's pertinent. So it's ongoing, constantly learning, and we're still learning with this every week.
Any further questions? Hearing and seeing none, thank you very much for giving us the update on that. We appreciate it a lot. And with that, let's move to the last item that we haven't talked about, the Board of Medical and Osteopathic Examiners. And Tim, if you want to kind of go through what was sent. They weren't able to make it today. The executive director was invited out to Washington, D.C. to be a part of the nomination for the new Surgeon General, I believe. So, anyway.
Margaret Hansen, the executive director, sent to us just a day or two ago a report that she prepared of the total receipts and disbursements into that other fund. And I'll just pass this out now. Senator Gillespie, I can email this to you or
sure,
send it
that'd
to
be fine. I'll just pick it up from you this week.
Okay.
She's not very specific in what we requested. Senator Hanoff.
Thank you. I don't know when she will be back, but I would certainly suggest that we ask her for a follow-up. And the issue about the balance in those funds mm-hmm. and licensing actions really is an impact. Anybody mm-hmm. that's got a licensing board has that. So mm-hmm. I think that
you know, we need to have some further clarification.
I agree with you.
Prior to, I believe, will they fall under Department of Health mm-hmm. for their budget hearing, and I'm not sure which day, if that's this week or next week. So
yep.
they well, need to have a much more detailed for that.
Detail for the plan?
Yes.
Plan for the money?
Yes.
Okay, I will send her an email this afternoon. And any other questions, anything else specific on that? Seeing none, we'll just get some more detail from her. I think she'll be back this week. Senator Hanoff.
Thank you. You know, to follow up on that, you might ask her what has been the expenditures regarding those quality issues and practitioner issues that she's addressing and give a five-year history for expenditures from that budget for those cases.
Okay. Did you get that, Tim? Okay. Are there any further questions on this particular sheet that was just handed out? Okay, seeing none, we'll go down to the last item on our agenda, the committee discussion. Well, I guess not. I did want to ask, we've got a couple of gals that walked in with the Board of Regents, and you kind of wanted to listen in on the airplane discussion. Is that correct? Kind of. We already had that discussion. So is there anything you wanted to comment on or anything? Yeah, come on up and introduce yourself.
Good morning. I'm Mary Ellen Garrett with the Board of Regents. I'm the accounting manager. I'm here for Monty Kramer as well as Dr. Warner. We had come in to listen to your discussion on if there were any questions with the Department of Transportation's report on the airplane usage. We were not able to listen to the to your hearing or your meeting today because the electronics were down. But however, I think what we probably would best be do would once that is available for us to listen to that discussion, and then if we have any other comments or anything like that, we can comment and write it to you and send it to you. That'd probably be the easiest.
Okay.
If there was any specific questions you wanted had for us that we could research before that or anything,
I think we will. Yeah, we'll try to get that done.
Okay.
Before the appropriations hearing. If there are specific questions, we'll try to have the questions before you get there.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for coming. I appreciate it. With that, let's go down to the last item on our agenda, the committee discussion on potential agenda items for future consideration. And at this point, I just wanted to thank all of you for your participation and attendance. It's that last year, I'm handing the gavel over to my co-chair here with Senator Teason, and he's going to take the reins for the next year. So with that, I just want to thank you and good luck, Senator Teason. And then you can deal with the future agenda items. How's that? There you go.
Gee, thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, I guess I would just say that we will certainly try to, I think traditionally at the end of session, we try to make our plan for the year. One of the things that I would like to do is try to get our dates put together for our meetings for 2010 so we can get those in our book and hopefully and follow those. Beyond that, I'm open for any discussions or suggestions that ideas that may come up now or during the session that we can add to our future agendas. Any issues that need to come forward now for consideration? In that case, we'll wait for some to develop.
Okay. I'll make the motion to adjourn.
Hearing no further business, I have a motion to adjourn. You've been superseded by Representative Peters.
There you go.
I accept your second, Representative Turbeville. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, we're adjourned.
Aye.